Resolute Square.
There was also maintained what was called an enemies list, which was rather extensive and continually being updated.
Democrats want Republicans dead.
Where I could stand in the middle of Fifth Avenue and shoot somebody and I wouldn't lose any voters, okay?
The women with the least likelihood of getting pregnant are the ones most worried about having abortions.
On January 6th of 2021, you had tens of thousands of people peacefully protesting.
No, it's not a right-wing conspiracy theory. It's not QAnon. It's real.
I'm Rick Wilson, and this is The Enemies List.
Hi, folks. I'm Rick Wilson, and welcome to The Enemies List. My guest today is Frank Bruni. You've read Frank in the New York Times. You've seen him on television. He has a tremendous new book out called The Age of Grievance, which is an examination of a lot of the things that seem to be driving our political culture, our national culture, of how deeply Americans have come on both the left and the right to depend on a sense of outrage and offense and grievance to define themselves and to define the world around them. I read it last night, Frank, and I thought it was absolutely tremendous. Talk to us about The Age of Grievance. What led you to write this piece? And then I want to dive in on some of the things that you talk about in the book.
Great. Thank you. Thank you for having me for this conversation. I felt, and I'm sure this will resonate with you, I felt that we were no longer having honest conversations in the political sphere. I felt that we couldn't find all those things that we talk about, not being able to find compromise, common ground, civility, because everyone, it seemed to me, not everyone, but most people were entering the political arena. They were beginning their discussions from a position of, let me tell you how I've been wronged. Let me tell you who's wronged me. And let me tell you how I would like to punish that person. I was blown away as this current 2024 campaign, you know, lurched closer and closer into view, as we saw the fight for the Republican nomination. I was blown away by how much in my lifetime the way people campaigned had changed. The candidates were all trying to prove, each of them, that he or she was angrier than the next person, that he or she would take more exacting and bitter revenge on your enemies. We've had the phrase negative partisanship, as you know much better than I do. We've had that phrase for 10, 20 years. We're seeing something beyond that now. We're seeing something I almost think of as apocalyptic partisanship. And I wrote the book because I wanted to understand how we got here and maybe how we could get out.
You know, I when I was reading it last night, I was thinking about like the origin story of a lot of this. And you point out that there is a little bit in the American character, like all the way back to de Tocqueville, who talks about like Americans have complaints about the advantages they don't have in the world because of our origin story. But I was thinking about this last night, and I as a former Republican, I looked at it and said, you know, the weaponization of grievance really came in emerged in the 90s out of Limbaugh, Ailes, and Murdoch, all sort of simultaneously building this media culture that said to Republican and conservative voters over and over again, you're the oppressed party. You're the one whose life is being, you're the one being punished for who you are. And that seemed to, it seems like that even before the social media world really took over, it seems like that part of American political life between the rise of Limbaugh and Fox and the election of Barack Obama, I think that feels to me like that's where a lot of the current seeds on the right of this very weird garden were planted.
Oh, absolutely. You know, and if you think about all that happened in 2008, right, you know, absolutely everything you say is true. You uttered two words, though, that if I may, I'd like to return to: social media. So Roger Ailes, Rush Limbaugh, you're right, they precede the social media age. Social media has taken an accelerant to all of that like we've never seen. And there are whole books just about the fact that anger is the greatest currency on social media. That's how you get your posts and your invective shared and liked and all of that. We have these mechanisms in place now, social media being primary among them, that encourage us to be angry, reward us for being angry, and don't reward us for doing the kind of hard work that would lead to a better society. And it's all performative. I mean, Rush Limbaugh presaged and set the stage for that as well. People do not begin and continue their political discussions with an interest in being substantive and with an interest in this progressing somewhere. It's almost entirely performative. And we're digging our civic grave with that.
You know, I can remember times when the Republicans and Democrats were divided, they would argue over like the marginal tax rate. Is it going to be 38.2 or 36.1? You know, there were these things where we fought over ideas and policies and questions like how many divisions are we going to deploy to Europe in NATO or things like that. And now it has become so, it feels so trivialized now. It feels so, I mean, it feels more personal, but more trivial at the same time. We don't seem to have the capacity now to have meaningful discussions where we get parties around a table and say, okay, here's crisis X we have to solve, whether it is climate or something economic or some foreign policy question or anything. It doesn't feel like either side. I mean, I'm being an equal opportunity judgy here, but it doesn't seem like either side wants to come to the table most of the time with anything that would make them walk away from the predicate that they have that they're the oppressed one.
Yeah, this is a tough thing to talk about because, as you just kind of talked about both sidesism or whatever, this is a tough thing to talk about because while I don't think the grievances are equivalent on the right and the left, I mean, there's no equivalence here. We have the political violence that we've seen and that we should be most worried about is a phenomenon of the right, not the left, 100%. Disproportionately. There is a disregard for truth on the right that far outpaces any disregard for truth on the left. But the reason I said this is tough to talk about is on both sides, we see the same impediment to honest conversation, which is they enter the sorts of talks you just mentioned, and their first priority isn't how do we find a solution, it's how do I get the political advantage here? How do I embarrass the other side and exalt my own? And that's not a question that leads you to solving a problem. Everyone also comes with these predetermined agendas, these predetermined lenses, these brands in the modern parlance, right, that they layer onto any set of events. So something happens, and if my brand is that the world is irredeemably sexist, I look at what happened for the evidence of that, even if that's not the main storyline. If my brand, conversely, is anti-establishment, anti-elite, government is corrupt, I layer that lens onto any set of circumstances so that I can come back to my predetermined conclusion. How do we ever solve any problems if people are engaging with each other in that fundamentally intellectually dishonest way?
I think that's a really important point, Frank, that we have this brand first, me first. You know, I call it the hamster wheel. And I do see this operate on, again, I'm not a both sides guy. I try not to be. But I see a lot of people in the political process who say, okay, I found an issue that either offends me or offends my people. I'm going to throw gas on that fire. I'm going to talk about how the other side is trying to silence me. I do think it's more stark and dishonest on the right as it is constituted today. But that hamster wheel of, you know, people, someone asked me recently, like, why does Marjorie Taylor Greene say these crazy things? I'm like, because she is an email fundraising person, not a political figure.
Because she's rewarded for saying those things, you know?
Right. She gets right. The incentive structure is so upside down in America now. You know, in Florida, we just got the news that Bob Graham had passed, moderate Democrat for years, and a guy that I was close to, I loved, even when I was a Republican, admired him, you know, grew up with the guy in our political circles. And, you know, he was this kind of person who would literally go like, I don't care about the politics of it. I don't care about whether it's good or bad for me. I'm going to do what's right for Florida. Well, now no one seems to have that kind of adherence. And I also feel like there's a departure from, especially in the political space, like people are less about where they're from, what their state needs, what their district needs, and much more about like what the movement needs, what the brand needs, what the broad ideological tendency needs. You know, we're all pressed for time, and eating better is really easy with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every one of their never-frozen meals is chef-crafted, dietitian approved, and ready to go in 2 minutes or less. You'll have over 35 options to choose from every week, including Calorie Smart, Protein Plus, and Keto, which I like. Also, there's more than 60 add-ons to help you stay fueled up and feeling good all day. What are you waiting for? Get started today and get after your goals. 2 minute meals. Fuel up fast with Factor's restaurant quality meals that are ready to heat and eat wherever you are. Pancakes, smoothies, and more. Wide variety of easy options for the entire day. Breakfast, midday bites, and more. These are no prep, no mess meals. The Factor meals are ready to heat and eat, so there's no prepping, no cooking, and no cleanup required. Factor's really flexible. You can get as much or as little as you need by choosing your meals every week. You can pause or reschedule deliveries anytime. And that's really helpful for someone like me with a travel schedule that can change at the slightest notice. Factor is the perfect solution if you're looking for fast, premium, no cooking options. Sign up and save today. We've done the math. Factor is less expensive than takeout and much healthier. And every meal is dietitian approved to be nutritious and delicious. Head to factormeals.com/Wilson50 and use code Wilson50 to get 50% off. That's code Wilson50 at factormeals.com/Wilson50 to get 50% off.
I agree with everything you're saying, but I do think there's some seeds or rays or whatever word you want to use of hope out there. And as you know, because you looked at the book, I spent a little bit of time talking about politicians like Larry Hogan, Andy Beshear, Charlie Baker in Massachusetts, amid all of this discord and dysfunction. We have popular governors in various states who are of the party that is not the majority in that state. And in part because of that, have had to put kind of culture war rhetoric to the side and focus on how do I fix your roads? How do I create more jobs in this state? How do I raise the prosperity level of this state? And how do I kind of make your education better if I can do that? Voters do respond in those states, and voters do respond everywhere to politicians who can somehow cut through all of this and focus on bread and butter. I hate that cliche, but forgive me, bread and butter, kitchen table issues. But the truth is that that's where I see hope and salvation. Voters do still reward that, but it's happening, unfortunately, as an exception rather than as the rule.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. You know, folks, there are always things people need to get off their chests. We carry around a lot of stress in this world. Some of it's big, some of it's small, but all of it, if we keep it bottled up, can affect our health in a negative way. Therapy is a safe place to get things off your chest, to figure out how to work through whatever's weighing you down, to learn how to deal with those stresses. I know so many people who've benefited so much from therapy. They find a safe place where they can talk about the challenges in their life, where they can learn positive coping skills, they can learn how to set boundaries, and they can learn how to assess what's happening in their world in a way that makes them that better version of themselves. Therapy isn't just for people who've been through trauma or suffered a loss. It's for everyone. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online. It's convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist, and you can switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. Make your brain your friend with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/Wilson today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/Wilson.
I think you're right. And there are those little, and it's funny, you named three people that I know well, and all three of them, you know, Larry Hogan and Charlie Baker and Andy Beshear, they really are, you know, how do we fix the bridge? How do we fix the roads? How do we get, you know, enough school lunches deployed? How do we do the practical mechanical things? You know, you talk about how the shining city on the hill became tarnished. I don't see as much of that among people in Washington as I do out in the States. There are people that want to get things done out in the States, for sure. I see much less of that in the DC. I think the incentive structure in the DC world is very perverted at this point, away from that.
No, you're totally right. It's an interesting phenomenon in American politics over recent decades. The closer you get to the local level, the more kind of real and the less theatrical the politicians become. People like and are often well served by their mayors.
Sure.
Many voters like and are often well served by their governors. But you are right. There is something about the culture, the hothouse of Washington, D.C., something about all of those media cameras. And we in the media need to look at how we're participating in that incentive structure, about how many headlines and how much ink we give Marjorie Taylor Greene and Matt Gaetz and the rest of them. But somehow when you travel away from Washington, you see a different, more hopeful America. And the question is, how do we import some of that back to Washington?
Support for Rick Wilson's The Enemies List comes from Odoo. If you feel like you're wasting time and money with your current business software, or just want to know what you could be missing, then you need to join the millions of other users who switched to Odoo. Odoo is the affordable, all-in-one management software with a library of fully integrated business applications that help you get more done in less time for a fraction of the price. To learn more, visit odoo.com/Wilson. That's odoo.com/Wilson. Odoo, modern management made simple.
I mean, and look, you and I are both, we can argue, part of the pundit industrial complex at some level. And it is easy to write the stories and write the op-eds and write the opinion pieces about the outliers, about the loud noises, the flashing lights, the crazies, the big picture. And I think that also ends up being that thing that repeats the grievance, sort of like that conveyor belt of grievance. You know, when you start paying attention to them more, they start saying, okay, well, I need to up the ante a little bit. You know, like J.D. Vance, as you write about in the book, you know, he goes from being a guy who writes one of the best regarded sort of biographies, and it was an insight into a part of America that a lot of people on the coastal elite world didn't understand. He has transformed into this punitive, because he, you know, you talk in the book about some of the speeches he gave during his Senate campaign, which is, you know, we have to go to Washington and we have to burn them all out. We have to fire them all. We have to put our people in charge of everything. And you can almost see Vance doing this as he gets more attention for doing it. He needs to do more. It's chasing this, like, this dragon of outrage all the time. And look, when Ron DeSantis was elected as governor of Florida, the guy did not run as, you know, as the character he ran in 24. It was not the guy who ran in 2018. And you ended up with this, you know, we're going to slit throats on day one, and the bigger and bigger and more performative nature of these things. I think people like us have to sort of take a blink too and go, am I elevating the worst case, you know, scenario of this person? Am I elevating the people that are never going to be part of running things or doing the things we need to do? Because I've been considering that a lot lately. Like, you know, we tend to be drawn to that outlier, the bonfire, rather than the slow burn.
Well, how did Vivek Ramaswamy get attention during the Republican primary? He got attention right. By going to those debates and performing more obnoxiously and childishly than I think I've ever seen someone perform on a debate stage, with the possible exception of Donald Trump early in the 2016 Republican. I mean, and he got the headlines, and he got the social media coverage. In his case, it didn't end up leading anywhere, but he is better known in America today. He probably commands higher speaking fees. He has a network he didn't have before, and it's not because he stood up there and said, I have constructive solutions. It's because he stood up there and taunted all of his adversaries and told you how he hated the people you hate even more than his peers on the stage hated those people. I remain blown away, Rick, by the fact that Ron DeSantis, who, despite the failure of his presidential campaign, has known great political success. He's the second term governor in Florida and was reelected by a very impressive margin. His signature line, his trademark line, is Florida is where woke goes to die. Death is a word in his signature line. Compare that 2 decades ago to George W. Bush, whatever else you think of him. His campaign was, I'm a uniter, not a divider. I'm a compassionate conservative.
I'm going to restore honor and decency to the White House.
Right. That sort of language, how did we get to a point where that sort of language has zero currency in the Republican Party anymore? And it has diminishing currency in the Democratic Party, too.
Yeah. I mean, look, there are a lot of people who
in the Republican world, and this is, you know, where I'm sort of the anthropologist of that thing, there are a lot of people in that world who look back at Ronald Reagan and George Herbert Walker Bush and George W. Bush as suckers and patsies and weaklings, and as people who didn't get that that we were in this apocalyptic battle and you talk about this. There's like a section of this that feeds this on the right of these right wing catastrophists who are always talking about, like, you know, this is the moment where unless we do X right now, we're going to plunge into communism or immediately, you know, convert the country will become Muslim or whatever, like fabulous.
Sharia law.
We're all going to be gay marrying Sharia law. You know, it's crazy. But there is a more gentry sort of think tank aspect to that that feeds a lot of these people these crazy stories and these crazy. And yes, by the way, folks, I'm not giving like crazy left wingers a pass here. There are a lot of things that are absurd to a lot of Americans that come out of the progressive side of the equation. But there's also something, I don't know that it exists on the left in the same scale. There are people on the right who are able to spot like the crazy academic paper, get it on Fox, talk about it, and convince a huge number of Americans that this is the only thing liberals think about.
Right. Are some of the issues that they bring up in terms of wokeism, are some of those issues legitimate ones that we need to discuss? Absolutely. But they would have you believe that the entire Democratic Party is in a seizure of wokeness. And that's not true. I mean, Joe Biden was elected over much more progressive woke adversaries, right? There's mm-hmm. a reason for that. The Democratic Party has not been overtaken entirely by wokeism. It has very disturbing strains of intellectual dishonesty, and I discuss them in the book. I try to look critically at both sides. I talk about the ridiculous notion that Brittany Griner was not getting attention from the Biden administration because she was lesbian and black and a woman. In fact, we knew more about
Paul
her predicament as a political prisoner. Right. So, I mean, that's what I mean by intellectual dishonesty on the left. But I don't see the same kind of burn it all down sentiment on the left. I don't see the catastrophism, which you just mentioned. There's been a real rupture and change in the American psyche, and pessimism and doomsaying sells in a way it never did before. And I feel like one of the fundamental changes I've seen in our culture, in our society, in our politics, in my lifetime is the turn from a fundamentally optimistic outlook, or at least a turn from a point where optimism sold. Remember the adages around Ronald Reagan, his success was because he was an optimist. Around that time, I mean, you know this way better than I do, any political consultant would tell a candidate, Democrat or Republican, you want to be the more optimistic person, you want to be the person they want to have a beer with. That's not the case anymore. Now, pessimism sells. And that's dangerous for a country's future.
Well, and I think that speaks to a lot of what Trump sold to this audience that I think had been pre-prepared for a long time through the Fox, Limbaugh, MAGA media sort of matrix. He sold them this, the brown people are coming to kill you. Wokeism, he didn't use wokeism in the way DeSantis does, but he built this cultural framework for them that said, okay, your outrage is justified. Your grievances are all real. I'm here for you. I'm the avatar of this for you. And I think because he was sort of a known quantity in celebrity world, he was sort of a figure that people had a distorted but tangible in their minds image of what he was. He's a billionaire. I think he really like hit the turbocharger on using grievance as the political cudgel that Republicans now go to all the time. There's nothing affirmative in their prescriptions for America. It's all, we have to punish our enemies, stop these people, take these people out of the process, put these people in jail. I mean, we can't undercount his impact on political culture and the grievance culture, I think.
No, and he had such an impact, and people respond to this because it is so emotionally seductive, right? If your entire worldview is about these grievances, you have no responsibility for anything. You have no accountability for anything. The failures or the shortcomings of your life, the dissatisfactions of your life, they aren't because of any lack of initiative. They aren't because of any lack of talent. They're because there is this culture, this system out there that is oppressing you. And if you can just attack and get rid of those people, then you'll be fine. But of course, you really don't want to get out of that mindset, because if you got beyond that, if somehow the world conformed to this imagination you have, then you would actually have to do an accounting of why your life wasn't the way you wanted it to be. As long as you can blame other people, and as long as you can stew in anger, you never have to take responsibility. You never have to take accountability. And we see that throughout American society across the political spectrum.
That is one of, I think, the biggest departures is, you know, Republicans used to talk about personal responsibility and accountability and integrity. And now it feels like this is just like a free pass to pretend that, you know, no matter what I do, no matter what I believe now or what I say now, it's justified because there's this apocalyptic outcome being imposed upon me and being imposed upon America by the left. And it seems like they want to justify any outrage they feel and then any behavior after that, whether it's January 6th or anything else, by saying, you know, the dear leader has told me this. I see this. I feel this. I see this on my news that I watch in my silo every day. And it just feels like there's a permission structure there for increasingly bad behavior.
You just said some really crucial words, which is, I see this on my news, right? That kind of statement you couldn't have uttered 20 years ago. Right. And social media is part of it, but it's an emblem and a component. It's not the whole thing. In our lifetimes, Rick, we have seen a change from when I was growing up. You had four news options at night if you were watching TV. You had ABC, CBS, NBC, and PBS, right? That was it. That was not a perfect world at all. There were huge problems with that. But now you have now all of life is a choose your own news, choose your own information adventure. And I mean, this was so vividly illustrated by the decisions that Fox News made that led to its $787.5 million settlement with Dominion Voting Systems. As we know from their emails, as we know from their internal texts, they knew that this garbage about the voting machines changing votes, being rigged or being corrupted or having gremlins inside them, they knew it was bunk. And they kept putting it on because they said, if we don't give our viewers this bunk, they'll just go elsewhere. They'll just go elsewhere. We live in a world where I can decide what the truth is without any evidence for it. And I can go online or I can spin the cable dial or whatever the right verbs are for changing cable channels. And I can find someone who validates for me, who affirms for me that the truth I want is the truth. And I can shut everything else out. That is such an overwhelming obstacle to civil conversations and to any sort of common ground.
And I think that there is a sense also in that civic common ground is now viewed by a lot of people as a net negative. I mean, this idea on the left and the right of triumphalism and catastrophism being hand in hand, of we're in the final battle, we must defeat the enemy, where, you know, we go back, you know, where Lincoln, he said, you know, we must not be enemies, you know, though passions may have strained us, we must remain brothers. All that sort of departure, I feel like the grievance culture will lead us into something unless we check it by a very conscious effort, I think, in the years to come.
The grievance culture tells us that compromise, that common ground, that centrism are failures of conviction. They're the province of weaklings. Actually, no, they're strategies for living. They're strategies for governing. They're strategies for taking a diverse country, diverse in so many ways, including ideologically, and making it work. You know, and we are so privileged to be living in this country and at this moment in time, right? But this is, at our peril, we forget that this is a unique experiment. Nowhere in the history of the world have we seen a nation attempt democracy on this scale with this kind of diversity And it's a very, very fragile thing as we're seeing right now. And one of the things that that's one of the things that concerns me most, and one of the reasons I wanted to write about it. I don't think we appreciate its fragility, and I certainly don't think we adjust for its fragility and act in the ways that will guarantee our future.
What was the most surprising thing you learned writing this book? I like to ask people that question because I feel like we know it's bad. When I was reading it last night, I was like, I wonder when he started this, if he knew it was going to be as bad as it is, the division and the sort of negative incentives. What was the thing that surprised you most about writing this book?
I'm going to give a sort of sideways answer to that, or probably an answer you weren't expecting. I was fascinated before I wrote the book about this turn toward pessimism in the country. And as you know, I devoted a whole chapter to it. And I was kind of most excited to write that chapter because I am so fascinated by that. Although I already had convictions about how pessimistic we'd become and what the markers of that were, when I really kind of studied and focused on it, I was blown away because the dimensions, the magnitude of our pessimism and the manifestations of it are far beyond what I realized. And there's a section in that chapter about the entertainment we consume mm-hmm. and how much it's mm-hmm. changed. And I found myself going down this rabbit hole. Do you realize how much time Americans spend watching zombies? Zombies here, zombies there, zombies everywhere.
I love your description of AMC as now a zombie delivery network.
But that's meaningful. You don't end up with that many zombies and it means nothing. I was most intrigued, kind of most fascinated in a geeky way. With how our entertainment has changed and come to reflect all the things you and I are talking about. It is phenomenal. It is disturbing in the extreme that Squid Game is the most watched thing Netflix has ever streamed. Have you seen Squid Game?
Yeah.
I mean, that's a violent dystopia like has never been imagined. And the fact that that speaks so powerfully to 20-somethings and 30-somethings and teens. That's who was watching it. That is a huge, huge alarm for all of us.
I think that is a fascinating insight in the, like, sometimes the culture tells us things upstream of the politics rather than downstream of the politics. So, well, folks, the book is The Age of Grievance by Frank Bruni. It is tremendous. I really recommend it. When does it come out, Frank?
It comes out April 30th.
Outstanding. Well, folks, check it out where all fine books are sold. Frank, thank you so much for coming on the show today. Really appreciate your time, and it's a great book, and I look forward to talking to you again soon.
I enjoyed talking to you, Rick. Thanks so much.
Thanks again for listening to The Enemies List. If you have any comments, questions, or if there's someone you'd like to hear on the podcast, hit me up on Twitter at TheRickWilson. Thanks again for the wonderful support you've shown the pod. We're growing fast. It really helps if you will share this with your friends, your family, and anyone else who, like us, is trying to save democracy. While you're at it, if you could rate and review the podcast, I would be very much appreciative. I know this is the sort of thing you've heard a billion times. Please rate, review, like, blah, blah, blah. But you need to do it. It really does help us a lot. We are slaves to the algorithm, my friends. And if you do this, it will help get the pod out further. Anyway, thanks again for listening. I'll see you next time. And remember, whatever you do, stay off the list.